core function in society at large that got to wake up.
I'm Diane Donovan. You're listening to Classic Lost, and I had a very interesting conversation with my next guest. Something a little beyond the genre of classical music, but a very fine musician. Andrew Bird, the multi-talented violinist, songwriter, singer, and world-class whistler, has an upcoming performance at Bass Concert Hall on Wednesday, September the 17th, to celebrate the 20th anniversary of his very fine album, The Mysterious Production of Eggs. Yes, all of the music from the album, as well as other fan faves. He'll be performing with the Central Texas Philharmonic, and I'm pleased to say that he is my guest at this time. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You started out as a classical violinist. Could you tell us about your early days, or who or what inspired you to play the violin, and would that have been your first choice of instruments?
Well, I was 4 years old, so I wasn't, very conscious to say, Mom, Dad, I want to play the violin. So my mom had this idea of her kids all playing classical music. So I started the Suzuki Method when I was four, and that meant a Cracker Jack box with the ruler taped to it, where you'd come to the class and bow to the teacher and pretty much go home. It was all kind of fun, and you learned respect for your teacher, and that was about it. And then it was a very pure form of the Suzuki Method, where it was really by ear. There were these volumes of the repertoire, so it would be like a folk tune, and then it'd be Bach and it'd be Mozart, but it was like folk music, but it happened to be a lot of classical pieces, which was by design. That's how Dr. Suzuki intended it, to learn music while you're learning language. But I really didn't learn how to read. And then I was 12 or 13 and started playing in youth orchestras. It was could absorb things very quickly. So I would often learn difficult passages just by ear. So in a sense, it's like, yes, there was a classical technique, there's a classical repertoire, but it was really more like an oral tradition as far as the way I learned it. So when I left the classical world after Northwestern Music School, I just easily made the leap into folk music and then writing my own songs and, really not working with the written note as a communicator. So, and I really didn't look back much until the last few years.
You have such an amazing knack for melody and such. And I read in one interview that the music, your songs come somewhat easily to you, at least the first part.
Yeah, the melodies come very easily. It's kind of, it just comes with waking up in the morning. There's likely to be some new melodies popping into my head. And then the process of trying to, I'll weed out the best melodies that I have. And then usually I think this needs to be sung, so I need lyrics. So I point that melody at what I care about, what I'm thinking about, and then wait for these words to fit into the nooks and crannies of the melody, which is a really hard way to do it.
Wow. I have to say. You've put out, I believe it's 18 albums. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done that process the opposite way, where you're, for example, your tune Sisyphus? I don't mean you did it on that one, but if you're thinking of the myth, you're already kind of writing the words and then melody.
That's comes. A good example of one where I did, where there's the verses are kind of a rhythmic wordplay rant, and that is more driven by the lyrics and the rhythm of the words, and then the chorus comes and it's more melodic. But yeah, there are some like that, and Sauvet from Mysterious Production, where it's more done the other way around, and it's a melodic motif where there's purely a melody, and then a word can also have a hook to it, or a particular string of words can be a motif as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. You're celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Mysterious Production of Eggs. Now, how do you hear it differently with full orchestra? Does it feel very different? Or
yeah, it is. It's inherently different having 50, 60 people on stage performing it. And, right after I made this album, I went on the road solo, looping, playing guitar, doing this kind of high wire act. And it was, I didn't really worry about the details that were on the album. I just sort of got down to the bare bones of the song. Now, this is an opportunity to go back and because it is a very detailed to real finally realize all these little intricate counterpoint things and assign them to this whole color palette of the orchestra.
So, did you do the orchestrations?
I did not personally do it. Nate Thatcher did it, but it hews pretty close to the original recording. There's a few embellishments here and there, but I wanted this one to kind of stick closer. Earlier, I did some arrangements with Gabriel Kahane, and they were totally reimagined and like harmonically out there. The record is already has a lot, all the, like I said, a lot of this detail, and it's made sense to kind of stick to the album.
Yeah, and as a famous classical composer said, there are many more things to be said in the key of C major, and not that yours are in C major, but sometimes.
No, I always like that quote. When people say it's all been done before, I said, no, I don't really like, I don't know what the point is of declaring that. There's so many different ways, even if it's not to write something completely new, but then the performance of it, the phrasing of it, there's so many variations, endless variations.
Tell us about the whistling, because you really are quite a master whistling. How did that begin?
I just did it incessantly. You know, that Suzuki repertoire was like, it was just ingrained into you. And then the whistling, like I would be whistling, I'd have to stop whistling when I would eat, I guess, or sleep. But it was like, even if I wasn't audibly whistling, I'd be kind of breathing in and out to melodies, you know. So it is such a sort of unconscious, casual thing you do while you're doing dishes. It took me a while to think that this is a worthy thing because violin is, you know, a painful instrument and difficult instrument to learn. And then to find out that the money's really in whistling is kind of a, it's kind of hard to accept. But it is like a really effective way to carry a melody, and it really cuts through everything. It gets people to stop and listen. And so I started realizing that it was just a great tool. First of all, my hands are pretty busy with the instrument in my hand. And so if you need to carry the melody without singing, it's like whistling is oftentimes it was just like a placeholder. It's like, oh, here's where the melody goes. And I whistle it. And then a couple of times that ended up on the recording. I was like, well, there's nothing more. I can't, everything else I've tried instead of that is not as honest as the whistling. And yeah, it's like there'll be, I'm even gonna attempt to do this Ravel Pavane pour l'enfant défunt
For dead princess.
arrangement. Yeah, because we're doing a couple pieces that are you know not from the out that are classical pieces. Something from Dvorak and then that Ravel piece, and I'm gonna attempt to whistle because it's such a perfect, like Ravel is, that melody is so perfectly suited to like the long phrase of whistling and the sort of glassy tone of it.
You just mentioned two of my favorite classical composers, so we're in for a treat with that as well. And I have to say, I was really surprised by your jazz release of last year, Sunday Morning Put On. Pretty amazing. You reimagined the tune so well
That even though I knew these popular standards, it took me a while to kind of recognize them. Felt like it woke up my ears. Any more ideas in jazz or jazz whistling?
Yeah, I don't, that was just sort of like one of those sabbatical type projects that are, it's between albums, and jazz music has kind of been a constant through all the years, at least from 18 on. And I just wanted to see if when I really focused just on this genre, how much I could realize what I'd learned over the years. It was a little more like a not academic project, but it was like a something I had to really woodshed, and as opposed to writing my own stuff, is a little more just sit on the couch and you know hack away at it for years. But the jazz thing was like, okay, I'm gonna buckle down and I'm gonna learn that, you know, I'm going to transcribe that Coleman Hawkins solo, and I'm going
Yeah.
to, really learn what's going on. I kind of know in my ear what's going on, but I haven't connected it to my instrument.
Right.
And yeah, I also wanted to mess around with like how, like the Chet Baker stuff, where he'll be singing and then pick up his horn and play right after he sings. Like to connect the vocal to the instrument was,
So close.
yeah.
Is there any form of music that you have not yet written, and can we be expecting yet another of the many sides of Andrew Bird?
I mean I don't know. I yes, I'm sure there are. I've always envied some bands that where the lead singer shows up with just a notebook full of poetry, and then the band just plays three chords, and then you
Right.
make the words fit the chords and find the melodies. Like I imagine that's probably like the Smiths were like that, or like Morrissey, poetry driven, or Patti Smith. That kind of approach is because everything is so through composed with the way I do it, and I think it would be kind of liberating to do things that way if I can, if I could.
Yeah.
I really want to thank you for taking the time today for Classical Austin. We look forward to your show on September 17th at Bass Concert Hall, and you will get to hear the mysterious production of Eggs backed by the Central Texas Philharmonic. As well, you'll be doing other pieces. You might surprise us, as you said, with a classical work or two. We're very much looking forward to it. Can't wait for your concert. Thank you for taking the time, Andrew Bird.
Thanks for having me. Great talking to you.
Here's a little